From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1892, not 1492, 1892, 400 years after Columbus did what he did, and American schools often lionize Christopher Columbus. That's been true for a long time. And in 1892, a man named Francis Bellamy created what we would now know as the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, there was a small framework in place for a kind of pledge that came before Bellamy, but he thought it was a little childish, not thoughtful enough, and he wanted some way to have kids recite something that would have meaning, that would instill a kind of value and a nationalistic kind of viewpoint. Well, it kind of depends on what you think is the difference between patriotism and nationalism. And today we've got the Pledge of Allegiance. In fact, I heard an elementary school student just last year tell me that if I don't recite the pledge, I have to go to the principal's office. The pledge itself has gone to American courts and to the high courts, and it's all one small part of a big story of what patriotism is and how it is taught in schools. Patriotic Education in a Global Age is a new book, and one of the co-authors is a University of Rochester professor who you've heard on this program before. Randy Kern is back on the program to talk about his new book and what it means to instill civic virtue, patriotic education, nationalism, and the difference between nationalism and patriotism. We got a lot of ways we could take this conversation. We've already heard from some of our listeners this morning. We've got questions and comments, and we will take more as we go throughout the hour. But first, let me welcome the co-author of Patriotic Education in a Global Age, Professor Kern. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did this, the subject for a book like this right now, come up?
Yeah. Well, actually, the subject came up quite a while ago. If you go back to the period immediately after 9/11, those of us with children in schools experience extraordinary movement towards patriotic messaging in schools at that time. The music played at any musical concerts or at any events. The music was infused with patriotic tunes like never before. Other aspects of it in schools. And there were many political philosophers, educational philosophers who were noticing this. And a debate grew up around it about the merits of this and what kind of thing patriotism is, whether there are distinct benefits in trying to cultivate patriotism in schools, whether there are hazards. What do we know about the payoffs and risks of trying to cultivate patriotism? There are obviously forms of patriotism which can have hazards. When people are fearful in time of war and they close circle in a defensive posture, their reactions can be highly racialized. So after 9/11, the newspaper reports of 700 potential terrorists now in custody, 1,400, and it went up to about 3,000. And I think people welcomed this. They didn't worry themselves too much about the fact that this was essentially all racial profiling and rounding up of people who had overstayed their visas, but who had not and otherwise done anything wrong. My experience was most people were not the least bit concerned that habeas corpus had been suspended, which in principle meant that any of us could have been detained summarily, indefinitely, secretly, without the government showing cause for detaining us. That's what habeas corpus does. It requires the government to show cause for holding anyone in custody. So there were serious concerns about the way patriotism manifested itself and the way it was, at least to some extent, manipulated in the rush to invade Iraq, for instance. So a scholarly literature grew up in that period. We began to, we made the decision to write this book. It took 7 years to write it, and I'd be quite honest, over the span of those 7 years, I began to wonder if the topic was still as relevant as it had been.
Well, it's more, I think.
Well, I think so. I think we, in a weird way, we the book turned out to be more timely as of roughly 2 years ago. I think anyone who's been reading the newspapers over the last 2 years, there's hardly a day that you don't see references to patriotism in the stories surrounding what's going on.
Just 2 days ago, the president said he doesn't think dissent is patriotic, and he thinks it's an embarrassment that the country allows dissent,
right?
Allows protest.
Right. Well, that's the voice of authoritarianism.
Yeah, not even really trying to mask itself. But
yeah.
But so again, there's so many different questions that we could have, and you could probably teach an entire course on just this book alone. But you mentioned one of the concerns about patriotism being after in times of war and times of strife. And the book, even though you warned me before the hour began, you're not the historian.
I'm not the historian.
Co-author right. on this project. But the yeah. book makes note of how often throughout our history that a time of war or a time of crisis, take 9/11, et cetera,
yeah.
We have seen a flood of either patriotic symbolism in schools, patriotic teaching, ceremonies,
right.
and then even the Supreme Court ruling for the first time on whether we can make students say the Pledge of Allegiance
right.
came not long after a historical event.
The fall of France.
The fall of France.
yeah.
And lo and behold, within 3 years, you had members of that court regretting
right.
their opinion that they joined.
Right.
And then essentially looked for a way and found a way to change that
right.
going forward. So I find that history fascinating. And so it's sort of a bit of a warning. But some listeners might be saying, but are you talking patriotism or nationalism? And how do you define
yeah.
this?
Yeah. So good. You've asked a number of things. So very briefly, if you look at the history of the American public school system, it's really striking how much the system expanded and developed in response to large waves of immigrants. So the two foci of patriotism in American schools have been war and anxieties about loyalty and the good of the country in time of war, and anxieties about large waves of immigration. And the response of the country with regard to immigration was, I think, pretty sensible, which is that we grew a system to accommodate eventually all children, so that foreign-born, native-born were educated together on, as much as possible, terms of equality, a commitment to equal opportunity, trying to make schools welcoming to all children. And that probably did a world of good. The element of war and anxieties about loyalty and the good of the country during war is the other big piece of it. You can see the advent of World War I, a lot of patriotic messaging and then in World War II. So World War II is the major focus in both the second chapter, where we talk about the origins of flags being in schools, because they had not been originally, and the origin and development of the pledge. And so the legal history you're referring to is really quite fascinating. So France fell in World War II. Felix Frankfurter, the Supreme Court justice who wrote the majority opinion, in the case where, so the case, sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. The case was that a Jehovah's Witness family with two children decided that they could not, in good faith, recite the pledge. So the Jehovah's Witnesses, just so you understand, were being persecuted in Hitler's Germany. They were a religious minority being persecuted there. We can assume they were in the United States hoping to escape persecution. And I don't think we mention in the book, but the original pattern of the salute to the flag was the arm extended with the hand palm out in a way that looked very similar to the Heil Hitler pledge. So that must have been a bitter little detail of having their children being required to pledge the flag in that particular manner, which is obviously not how we do it now. So they were, this led to a Supreme Court case on whether school districts could constitutionally require all children to pledge the flag despite, as in this case, their religious objections. And so they had argued it was incompatible with their faith. And in the anxiety of the fall of France and the West shaken by this, the court upheld the constitutionality of school districts requiring the pledge. What immediately followed was in the newspapers, high-minded folks debated the merits of this. On the streets, there was vicious persecution of members of the Jehovah's Witness faith. There were arsons, there were physical assaults, there was even one instance of a tar and feathering. So the court, in watching what happened in the society, began rethinking it. There was also some changes in the court, and Robert Jackson, who I regard as one of the great constitutional heroes of the American judicial tradition, became the Chief Justice. He went on to be the Chief Prosecutor in the Nuremberg Trials, which is it's very interesting, interconnected bits of our legal history. But watching what happened and with the changes in the court, there was then a second case where this was reversed, and it was and so the position, and this is the state of our current law, is that laws requiring children to pledge the flag were in that case and since then deemed not to be constitutional. So children may be told that they have to go to the principal's office, but the school then is probably violating their children's constitutional rights.
But we still hear that today.
We do hear it today.
And there have been, you know, different flavors of challenges on different grounds over the years, but essentially that's the one that has stuck technically. So
yeah.
So in other words, if a child comes home and says, I have to pledge the flag, otherwise I'm going to the principal's office, if you really wanted to, you could probably make a good legal case to that.
You could. Yeah.
Yeah. And so is that a version of trying to teach kids to be patriotic or nationalistic, do you think?
Okay. That was the other big part of your
question. Yeah.
So here's the way the distinction would be made. So there's some varying nuances of how people define patriotism, but the focus of patriotism is the good of a country. That everyone agrees on. The focus of nationalism is the good of a people. A people defined by reference to a common religion, language, culture, nationality. That's what we mean by a nation, is a people that share some distinctive cultural, religious, or ethnic patterns. So when we talk about a nation state, we're sort of talking about the idea of a state being the, as it were, the home of a distinctive people. The United States has never been a nation state. We've always been a multicultural society, as a matter of fact. So we were never a nation state. We talked about Americanizing immigrants, that is, trying to educate them in a way that would cultivate a sense of shared identity, right? So that we all understood ourselves as Americans and had some shared reference points in what would constitute being an American, and where the focus was our constitutional traditions and our sharing a common land that we make our homes in. That was the essence of American patriotism, was not a kind of nationalism. It was a devotion to a country where we were all citizens of it, members of it, despite not sharing common religion, race, nationality, or even language. We did we did make it a matter of policy to try to make sure everyone could speak English mm-hmm. so that we had one common language that we shared.
And as you mentioned, the history of responding mm-hmm. to immigration in various ways even shows up with the Pledge of Allegiance, because the initial, Bellamy's initial language with the Pledge of Allegiance
<My flag. laughs>
was, I pledge allegiance to my flag.
Yeah.
And by, 1923, if I'm remembering in the book, there were enough concerns raised that, look, immigrants might just take that to mean they can pledge allegiance to whatever flag they came from.
Yeah.
So it needs to be the right. flag of right. the United States right. of America.
Can't be the Italian flag or the Russian flag. It's got
to
be the...
Which seems right. to be like a mildly paranoid response
right.
to that.
Well, it's... Lawyers tend to be... Well, it's not just lawyers, yes. Acutely attuned to nuances of language. So, yeah, that was a worry about it.
And I see the... In fact, we've got several phone calls already lined up. So before we go any further here with Dr. Randy Curran, who's a co-author of this new book about... teaching patriotism in a global age. Let me just ask if I could read one passage, and then you can let me know if you have sort of an overarching aim for readers and for the utility of this kind of a book.
Sure.
The passage that stands out to me, and there are many, is you write, "We say that love of country is a suitable goal of civic education only to the extent that it may be a product of an inclusive and enabling just school community that facilitates civic belonging and friendship, civic competence, and the accurately informed appreciation of the country's merits that is part of civic intelligence."
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty thorough way of saying, I don't want to interpret it the way I read the book. I want you to tell me where you want the
sure.
reader to be.
Sure. So... first, I want to commend you on being such a careful reader. That's a very important passage.
Is that a fair passage?
It's a very important passage that sums up some important things. So I can give you the short version or the long version. So the short version is part of what that says is that we think that a certain caring for the good of the country is a very likely outcome of educating children well. If you're making schools welcoming to all children, making them empowering, and I don't mean anything fancy by that. I mean that they learn, that the schools develop their sense of competence. They experience progress in their lives in a way that's satisfying, that puts them on a reasonable path to an adulthood. I think making them places where they experience themselves as equally respected members of the school community, I think that has a very, what we know psychologically is schools that meet children's needs, schools that are good for children in meeting their basic needs for competence and belonging and growing in their ability to make good decisions for themselves and direct their lives, those schools are going to be ones in which children will have a powerful inclination to make the values of the school their own. So if those schools are good places for children to be, they're learning things, the true things about the nature of the society that they're growing into. They can look around and perceive from their own experience that this is a society where they're valued and are offered the basis of equal opportunity. They're going to accept the values the school represents. That's overwhelmingly likely. By contrast, if you try to sell kids a bill of goods, if you sell them a mythologized false history of the country, if you try to turn the founders into deities in a way that's false and think that you have to do that to inspire an identification with the country and its values, I think you're making a big mistake. First of all, it's not the business of a government to seduce people into supporting its policies. That's not how democracy is supposed to work. Right? The ideal of democracy is a society of equal citizens who perceive where we perceive each other as fellow citizens who can collectively do good things together. And where the ideal is we reason together in a way that is transparent and not deceptive, where we try to solve problems in a way that's grounded in evidence about the nature of the reality we're dealing with, and where we believe in the very idea of a civilized society, which is that we can live better by cooperating than we could live outside of a cooperative society. So belief in mutual advantage on the basis of fair terms of cooperation and collective problem solving. So I think there are models of civic education that are predicated on that, including what the progressives called community civics. You know, think of society as a cooperative venture in trying to solve our problems together, which requires honesty and fact-finding and so on. So I think the psychological evidence, what we know about learning and civic and moral learning is schools that are good for kids, that are representing what I think are American ideals, will do just fine. And kids will come out probably caring about the things that are important. You won't have to trick them. So here's a basic way to crystallize this. Would trying to cultivate patriotism per se through any means be on the checklist of what teachers should do? The answer in this book is no. And if the question is there a virtuous or a desirable form of patriotism as a sort of responsiveness to the value of a country, to what's good in a country? I think the answer is yes. And do I think that's important? I think yes. But trying to cultivate it in many of the ways our schools have tried, I think are not justified.
Don and John on the phone, please stay there because I'm taking your calls first. I just want to close this point because this is, I think, so important to understanding this book. And I'll see how I would do if I were posing as a student in Randy's class here. Because what I think I would write in a term paper is that there is a false bifurcation we have when we look at, essentially, we kind of bifurcate. There's two options. You can teach kids that America is great and exceptional, and has done great things and almost exclusively great things, and teach patriotism and et cetera. Or you can be sort of an anti-American, you know, loathe your own country, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And what I'm hearing from Professor Curran is there's actually a much more interesting, complex middle ground, which is that if you level with students and you commit to teach accurately, which means that in a couple of months when students start learning about Thanksgiving, it's not, you know, some perfect party among natives and settlers, and there was very little strife and everyone was breaking bread and having corn together. That if you can level with students, that you don't risk them saying we're a terrible country. Yeah. What you end up with is students getting a more honest, accurate, complex view of history, and also a love for a country that can grapple with its history honestly while aiming to those high ideals.
Right. Yeah, right. I know. I think it is, the book does mark out a kind of middle ground, as you've said, and it's a more complicated view than the stereotypical for and against or stereotypical debate. So, it's a view of civic education where the focus would be on sort of three building blocks of constructive civic contribution, and one is a cultivation of civic intelligence.
That's a phrase, by the way, that I marked down.
Yeah.
After our phone calls, we're going to come back to exactly what you mean.
Sure.
So we'll return there.
Yeah. So civic intelligence, civic friendship, which involves a commitment to certain norms of a fellow citizenship that preserves the basis for cooperative civic and political relationships. We have an astoundingly polarized public now. And that's undermining the functionality of our democracy. A democracy is a complex system. You can specify institutional aspects of it, but you'll never be able to specify enough mechanisms and checks and balances for it to work without people honoring norms of cooperation. And that begins in tolerance of us not all being the same, and ideally more than just tolerance. I think if we educate children from different sectors of the society together so they actually know each other, that's very helpful. If you have actual friends who are, say, Syrian, it becomes much more difficult to demonize and be fearful, irrationally fearful, of a few Syrian immigrants.
All right, let me get our first phone call. John and then Don. John first. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Very, very interesting conversation. Would you please add the word jingoism into this discussion?
Sure.
It seems to me that that's a word that not enough people really understand, and what I think I'm seeing an awful lot of today is what I would classify as jingoism, and I would call it destructive.
Well, what's your definition of jingoism, John?
Super patriot, or super patriotism. That would be my definition of it. And by that, I would mean uber patriotism to the point of getting yourselves into 1930s Germany, current Russia, things like that.
Okay. John, thanks for the phone call.
Okay, Professor? Sure. I mean, so I think a common way to think about jingoism is that it does involve an elevation of one's own country above all other countries, and in a way that is hostile to international cooperation and that tends towards war. It's a form of patriotism that might embrace the phrase "my country, right or wrong," and might be favorable to empire. So we've had manifestations. Teddy Roosevelt had something like that. Teddy Roosevelt was in a period of American history where we were trying to build an empire. We were making war. We were trying to build an empire. And jingoism in that sense has certainly manifested itself in American history. The basic view in the book is that in this era, if not all previous eras, but I think especially in this era, our well-being, whatever country we're in, our well-being requires global cooperation. Many of the worst problems, biggest problems we're facing spill across national borders in a way that makes our collective fate as human beings so interconnected that if we don't find ways to cooperate, thinking ourselves partly as global citizens and not just citizens of our own countries, that our kids are going to be doomed. So I don't think any helpful form of patriotism would elevate our own country at the expense of others. We need to cooperate as citizens of this country, internally within this country to do well, and we need to cooperate in fair ways with other countries to get the cooperation we need for us to do well collectively across the globe.
You've lit a fuse here. We've got a lot of phone calls to get through. Don, and then I'll take Sean next. Go ahead, Don.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to relate an experience that I had when I was a senior in high school, which was almost 50 years ago. It was in 1970. It was the height of the Vietnam War, and many people in my school, we refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning. And it got to be that as many as one-third of my homeroom class would refuse to stand or say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I don't know whether anybody was ever sent to the principal office, But I remember one day that the homeroom teacher spouted out that we must have been treasonous communists or something to do something like this. And, well, I don't accept that label even now. But and also another thing is that about jingoism and panic, the best example of that is what happened to the Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor.
Sure.
They the federal government, the liberal president Roosevelt issued a proclamation ordering all Japanese Americans to be moved away from the West Coast, and 120,000 were put in concentration camps. They had no writ of habeas corpus. They had no trials. They were just rounded up.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court ruled in 1944 in the Korematsu case that was legal.
Yeah.
And they have never retracted that decision. So it still stands. It could happen again, and this country needs to be aware of what can happen when we have things like this.
Yeah, Don, thank you. I'll let the professor respond to that. And it's interesting. I thought of a number of these sort of instances in reading the book. You know, Don brings up internment issues like that.
Yeah.
It's natural and understandable that after a Pearl Harbor, a 9/11, that there is a joined community, a shared sense of purpose, a response to tragedy, even skyrocketing approval ratings for whoever's president at the time. Mm. I think that's all understandable.
It's understandable.
The concern that I'm hearing from you is that if we couple that with sort of an educated society that is maybe not, doesn't have as much civic intelligence, that the response isn't just an arms-linked coming together, it also can target based on racial grounds, based on ethnic grounds, and lead to unjust response that unfortunately we did see after Pearl Harbor, that we did see in many instances.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very important example. I've taught the Korematsu case a number of times, and the students are typically shocked by it, that it could have happened here. My father, who served in World War II, when I first learned about it and asked him, his response was just, well, we were afraid. And this is an unfortunate thing. I mean, I think people responding with fear do things that are both wrong and I think often counterproductive. So lashing out when you've been hurt and you're afraid is often not very smart. Orwell put it very well. Orwell wrote one of the most famous works about patriotism in the English language in his room with the bomb fragments raining down on the roof of his apartment in London during the Blitz early in World War II over London. And he said, in Britain, you know, we have people who know they're patriotic, and they would be mortified if you accused them of being intelligent. They said they contrasted themselves with the pointy-headed intellectuals. And then you had intellectuals who would be mortified if anyone suspected them of being patriotic. And he said, this cannot stand. He said, this country will not survive unless we can figure out how to wed patriotism and intelligence. Because we're not going to get through this war without rallying around to its defense and valuing our freedom. And we're not going to succeed in whatever effort we engage without intelligence. And the key lesson in that is be brave, right? Courage is a virtue. Reacting out of fear is not helpful often. It's often deeply counterproductive, as well as in these cases, deeply unjust.
All right, back to your phone call, Sean in Rochester. Next, go ahead, Sean.
Hey, one quick thing. When you started out the discussion today, you mentioned Francis Bellamy. And I think it's important to note that when we're teaching patriotism or teaching history at all, that we clearly identify all the facts. So Francis Bellamy was a socialist. He wrote the Pledge of Allegiance not for an American state, but he wrote it for a future socialist state that he envisioned, right? So understanding where that comes from, I think, is key to understanding the, how we can better break down historical knowledge and understanding for people in classrooms or general public, right? So understanding that and then starting from that starting point allows us to see how actually the pledge has been incorporated and used by the American state throughout history, you know, words under God added and so on and so forth throughout history. And I think that's critical when we're teaching to start from a starting point that that is accurate. So at the beginning, like I said, at the beginning of the program, alluding to the fact that he wrote it without mentioning that that really clear and important aspect could change the course of the direction of this conversation. So I just thought I'd bring that up and see what your panelists thought about that.
Sean, fair enough. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that.
He's right.
Well, I'm not sure he's entirely right. I mean, Bellamy, it's true, was a Christian socialist.
He was a
minister, and there was a Christian socialist movement in this country at that time, and it was focused on free and equal citizenship, which not all people had. It was also focused on trying to rebalance the balance of power between between laborers and factory owners. So to say that he was a socialist is true. Could that have been reflected in the language of liberty and freedom for all? Maybe. Do we believe in freedom and liberty for all? Yep. Maybe those are values that socialists and fans of democracy would share. So what? That does not condemn liberty and justice for all because socialists believe in them. Did he write the pledge for a future socialist state? No, I don't see any good reason to assert that. He was working for a magazine. It was the most popular magazine at the time for children. Is the Youth Companion. He was working for the magazine, the Youth Companion, in a way which if you want to taint it with something, taint it with commercialism. They were on a mission to sell flags, is the truth. That was the commercial interest at stake. It was in the lead up to the Columbian Exhibition, which was this big 400-year anniversary of Columbus and so on. And they were turning it into this huge patriotic extravaganza and trying to connect with it a campaign to create a massive new market for flags. And they did. They got flags into every classroom because you had to have a flag to pledge the flag. So if you want to taint it with something, a much more plausible as the proximate motivation was the motivation of the flag business in which his brother was engaged and the magazine he was working for. They sold a lot of magazines in connection with this.
All right. I'm late for our only break of the hour. We've got a lot of great phone calls and emails and questions and comments to get through. So if you have submitted one, if you're on the line, we're going to squeeze in everything we can get to with Randy Curran, who is the co-author of Patriotic Education in a Global Age, the new book. And let's get that break and come right back. I'll tell you what's coming up in our second hour. It's an upcoming festival at Ganondagan that explores food and culture from the Native American perspective. We're going to get a preview and discuss traditional and contemporary indigenous culinary experiences. If you're someone who loves to go out and do farm-to-table stuff, if you like to cook, this is an experience tomorrow that they're doing for the first time at Ganondagan, and I can't wait to hear all about this next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Carrie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Carrie.
Good morning. I'm actually calling with a quick anecdote. It was in high school, late 80s, here in upstate New York. And I was a teenager like every other, so the pledge would start. I kind of stood, rolled my eyes, you know, mouthed along with the words. But one particular day, I turned to my right, and there was a German exchange student sitting there, and the expression on her face, it's her first day in our class, was absolutely stunning. She looked forward as if she had never seen anything like it. She's looking around, kind of in alarm. And, you know, after everything had passed, I chatted with her later, and she just said, I've never seen anything like it. This would never happen in Germany. It would be just verboten. And it was a very strange moment for me as a kid to say, wow, so wait, this doesn't happen everywhere? This isn't kind of normal, or is it normal? And Germany's weird. It was really the first time that I ever thought about, what does this pledge mean? What is it? What am I actually saying when I put my hand over my heart and swear allegiance? So I will take my comments off you.
Thank you, Carrie. Yeah, what do you think, Professor?
Sure. Yeah, well, I can understand why Germans would be very nervous about it. The Germans, since the Second World War, have tried to develop a form of patriotism that's just focused on their new constitutional tradition. They're very nervous about any sort of any rituals of mass compliance. I mean, that is one way to think about the pledge. It was sort of invented as a ritual that was very tightly, elaborately choreographed, where everyone, without question, would just sort of on command engage in this ritual. And I think of it as kind of a ritual of mass compliance. And I mean, some people are nervous about it just for exactly that reason. I mean, I don't have strong views about whether it's beneficial or harmful, but I'll say one thing. When you look at the case of the Jehovah's Witnesses and think about related things, like after 9/11, every politician felt utterly compelled to wear a lapel flag.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so things that we might take to be healthy, a healthy focus or expression of our care for the country, can easily become required expressions of what side you're on, where people who are uncomfortable with them for one reason or another and don't display them can then historically have sometimes then been made targets of attacks. So it becomes a sort of required a symbol of what we really care about. I mean, I think what we should really care about is are people so sunk into partisanship or regionalism or boundless self-interest in such a way that they are not properly concerned with the, as it were, the common good of the country. I mean, that's what we should care about. There are many ways to manifest it. Is requiring everybody to recite a pledge where no one even thinks about what the words mean, is that a helpful way of getting us to where we're actually going to reliably defend what's good in the country?
Even Bellamy himself realized that pretty quickly. It doesn't have a whole lot of meaning for kids.
Yeah, it doesn't have a whole lot of meaning for kids.
Yeah. Ethan in Brighton, next up. Go ahead, Ethan.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
This is fascinating. There's a lot here. But I'll try to be succinct. You've actually hit on a couple of things while I've been holding. But you guys mentioned 9/11. I would take it all the way back to when I was a kid, and I remember being in art class, and every single kid was drawing Patriot missiles during the first Gulf War. Yeah. If you skip ahead to when I was in high school, I did not participate in the pledge, and I don't remember getting a hard time about it. I do remember my sophomore English teacher, however, berating us that there is, in fact, no comma between one nation and under God. And under God was something I was never super comfortable about at the time. So now I fast forward 20 years. Now, my son just transitioned from private school to public school and came home talking about the pledge yesterday. And I was thinking about it all again. And, you know, I want my son to grow up thinking of himself as a citizen of the world kind of first and America a little bit second. I think nationalism and patriotism, I think the line is pretty blurry. But beyond that is what you guys just hit on, is they're not telling him anything about what it means or why he's saying it. And so it really just kind of becomes this sort of pseudo secular opening prayer to the school day. And I don't think it really serves much purpose. And to maybe try to tie a bow on it. I consider myself very civically engaged, and it has nothing to do with whether I did or didn't say the pledge in public school. So yeah, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Ethan, thanks. I'm going to take your last comment there to ask about civic intelligence. You talk about being civically engaged, but before we do that, I'll just say, you know, Ethan thinks the pledge sounds kind of like a secular prayer to the government. The words "under God," as the book notes, were added during the McCarthy era,
right,
in which there was this concern that it would be all godless communists, and so we better throw "under God" into the pledge,
right,
which is a fascinating development for a ostensibly not theocracy. But regardless, regardless, that is the history. But regardless, what he brought up at the end there was this notion of civically engaged, and civic intelligence is a term, again, that you used in multiple passages here.
Yeah.
So what's the definition of civic intelligence, and are we doing a bad job at cultivating it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a sharp definition of it, but the sense of it is when we do anything, including in citizenship, we bring our intellectual potential, however it's developed, and we bring our values, and we bring what we can do into the decisions we make and how we act on them. And I think to engage in citizenship well, right, to display what you could call civic virtue or an inclination, capacity and inclination to act well in civic matters, you need to understand things. You need to be in the habit of trying to think things through. You need to pay attention to evidence where there's civic problems to address. So I think the preparation, the education that would prepare people to have and exhibit civic intelligence is going to have to give us a grounding in enough understanding of ways of knowing the world that we can understand enough of the context in which we're acting and acting collectively in trying to solve our problems. We need to be prepared to reason with one another, to be responsive to evidence, to know the difference between terrible arguments and good arguments, instead of sound reasoning and bad reasoning. We need to know enough about how our government works and what's at stake. That's the simple way to put it. It's about understanding and good judgment and making good decisions, whatever is foundational to those things.
Well, the last question I can fit in from a listener is a note from Gary about balance. And I think this is a really wise question, because there will be, inevitably, people who either hear Randy today or read this book and think, well, you're just another Marxist who hates America. You know, so you've revealed your true colors. When actually, the book is a call for a stronger, wiser country that is more durable and more equitable. At least that's how I read it. And so what Gary writes is, great conversation, especially reaching the balance between the postmodernist perspective of a work like Zinn's A People's History of the United States, in which America has done essentially nothing right, versus the Trump Republican America that says America has done nothing wrong. The question is, considering the fragmentized nature of our local school district system, how could you possibly implement such a balanced philosophy in schools?
How can it be implemented? Yeah. Well, I would encourage people to read the book, pay attention to an important strand of it, which begins in the progressive era with the idea that one of the powerful ways we can help kids develop as citizens is to try to directly engage them in civic activities, in work. The progressives saw it, including John Dewey, as sending kids out in the community to figure out what the problems are and how they might be able to contribute to them. During World War II, chapter 3 focused in World War II, the forms of public service in which kids engaged during the war. You know, initially you might be nervous about things that might look like militarizing schools, but it turned out a lot of the things kids were doing and trying to raise funds to help the war effort, in helping harvest on farms where there was a shortage of labor, various things that by their own accounts, and here's where some of the history was very original in interviewing people still alive who were went through it. It was a very powerful constructive experiences for kids in discovering themselves as able to contribute meaningfully to their society. And the Future Farmers of America that we talk about in that chapter, which is, I think, extremely relevant today for the situation of rural America and the thousands of dying towns where people feel abandoned by the system. There are models there for community-engaged civic learning.
Okay, well, I think the book is not only worth reading, but it's only about 130 pages.
It's short. It's designed to be short so you can actually read it.
It is svelte. The book's called Patriotic Education in a Global Age, and a lot of our listeners kind of keyed in on issues around the pledge, which I understand why. The book notes Robert Jackson, Justice Jackson, who had ties to Jamestown, New York, and my uncle was the director of the Robert Jackson Center down there, so I think it's worth going back and reading Robert Jackson's comments and his opinion about the pledge and forced orthodoxy and what it means. So really interesting stuff. Thanks for the book, Patriotic Education in a Global Age, from Randall Kern and Charles Dorn. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It was great.
All right, short break, more connections coming up.